autumn of 1949, after successful trials during the summer, a remarkable British aeroplane was unveiled at the Farnborough Air Show. It was to change the course of aviation and the pattern of travel in the world, something that Graham Boynton, travel editor of The Telegraph, knows all about. And here he is with Come Fly With Me.
Man has always wanted to fly, and in the 20th century that dream became a reality. Our passion for planes, and for jets in particular, has defined our view of the world in the second half of the century, and has turned us into restless travellers. When in the 1950s my family emigrated to Africa, we travelled on the Windsor Castle, by sea, because that was how people travelled long distances in those days. But if we'd looked up, we might have seen one of the first Comet jetliners flying down to Johannesburg. The trip took 24 hours and went via Rome, Tripoli, Beirut, Khartoum, Entebbe, and Livingston. It was the beginning of the jet age, which has culminated now in a multi-billion dollar industry that has crowded the skies with planes. That flight to Joburg takes just 11 hours now and costs not much more than the £315 return that it did then. And now I send journalists all over the world in sophisticated 500-mile-an-hour jets to report on holidays in places that were just a dream 50 years ago. This commercial jet age was born here in England, at Hatfield in Hertfordshire. At a hotel called the Comet, the aviators, engineers and designers who worked for the de Havilland plane-making company have assembled from around the world. They're here to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the birth of Comet One, the world's first jet airliner. The highlight of the evening is a flypast by Comet's closest surviving relative, the RAF Nimrod jet.
The great thing about that was not so much seeing it, but hearing it. That unforgettable sound of those screeching jets, you never hear it now.
In the crowd are several of the original crew, including the man they call John Cat's Eyes Cunningham, the ace wartime aviator who became de Havilland's chief test pilot, and Olivia de Havilland, the Hollywood film star who was the celebrity arm of the plane-making dynasty and one of its early glamorous passengers.
I don't know about being a glamorous passenger, but I was a passenger on a glamorous jet, and that was the Comet. In 1953, I made a flight from Paris to Algiers, and it was magical. And I was speaking to John Cunningham a little while ago, and I said, you know, it was an extraordinarily graceful and lovely-looking plane. And all the planes that have followed have actually emulated that original design, that marvelous plane first flown on this very day all those years ago by this adorable man.
It was on a day rather like this, but with the wind was not quite so brisk as this. So yes, it brings back very happy memories for quite a few years.
That noise which we bring you for the first time is one which in 2 or 3 years will be a familiar one at airports all over the world. The noise of a de Havilland Comet four-jet airliner, this beautifully shaped, swept-back-wing, 450-mile-an-hour British challenger for world airline supremacy, taking off in the hands of test pilot John Cunningham. Cunningham, 5 miles above the highest cloud in today's summer sky, 10,000 feet higher than any airliner has yet reached, called us up on his radio telephone.
De Havilland Comet to radio newsreel. Are now flying at 35,000 feet, a height slightly less than that at which passengers will usually be carried. This is the first time that the comet's been up to this height, As we have not yet had the pressurization working in flight, we are breathing oxygen. This moment I'm flying within about 15 miles of Hatfield with an outside air temperature of about 34 degrees centigrade below zero. This is the Havilland Comet returning you to the ground.
The race to produce a commercial jet had been made possible by developments in military aeroplanes during the war, when Frank Whittle's ideas about gas turbine propulsion were finally taken up.
One day during the war, we heard a strange aeroplane whistling around the airfield, and it was the Gloucester Whittle aeroplane coming to be demonstrated to the War Cabinet and some senior people. I mean, there were people like Churchill and all sorts of, you know, dignitaries, but we'd heard rumours about the jet engine and about jet aircraft, but, I mean, this aeroplane suddenly appeared in the circuit with a strange whistle, and everybody looked around, can't see a prop, this sort of thing. And, of course, it was then very secret, so it was isolated away from the, well, the workforce or anybody else.
John Bannon, who worked as a service engineer at de Havilland. The first airliners after the war had been uncomfortable converted piston-engine troop transports. They were unpressurized, so that to cross mountain ranges, the passengers were given oxygen masks. Later, the big-bellied Stratocruisers had bunk beds overhead like luggage racks, but the planes were low and slow, and turbulence tended to make the passengers sick. Sir Geoffrey de Havilland built his first plane in a shed in Fulham before the First World War. He designed the famous Moth biplane and tragically lost two sons in the cause of aviation. But he was determined to develop a commercial jet for Britain ahead of American competition. The factory went into overdrive. Ralph Hare was in charge of wing loading.
We have always, as a firm, accepted new challenges. It came through from Sir Geoffrey de Havilland. His attitude was to be seen throughout the factory. A tremendous amount of testing was done to derive basic information which could be used in design and was used in design. Hence, the efficiency of the structures where the metal or wood were very much improved and raised above the local knowledge of the time.
The whole factory would come out onto the airfield and watch the first flights. Well, of course, first flights were usually first hops, so the aircraft would go down and just leave the ground and make sure everything was all right and put it down and come back and perhaps do that two or three times. And if all was well, then you would go off on the first flight.
John Wimpenny was in charge of stability and control for the Comet.
We're flying much, much faster than anything we'd ever had before. I mean, we doubled the speeds. Of course, the problem of having acceptable control forces, you see that the human being has still got exactly the same strength in his arms. It doesn't make any difference whether he's going at 500 miles an hour or 50 miles an hour. So we would go for fully powered controls, which means that you have a hydraulic jack which pushes the controls around. You don't have to physically push them yourself. But of course, with that, there comes one huge technical advance. You have got to make absolutely sure that these things are never going to fail, because otherwise you're completely stuck. We have these what are called fail-safe design systems, where you deliberately engineer parallel versions of the thing. In this case, we had three. It's a triplex system. So the idea is, if one system fails, you've got to have more than two, because if you only have two, if one fails and the other's working, then you're never quite sure which one to switch off. So if you make the wrong choice, as we've known when people have switched off the wrong engine, you're in terrible trouble. So you've got to have three. And then you can have a majority vote on the three and see which is the dud one and cut that out.
Warning lights, landing gear, check, three green, changeover, set day. Landing gear doors,
one red,
set day. Landing gear warning light, set day. Fire warning, check, smoke detector.
By autumn, the Comet was ready for its public unveiling at Farnborough as the star in the de Havilland circus of new planes. Philip Birtles, chairman of the de Havilland Aircraft Heritage Collection.
The Farnborough show certainly was the showpiece then of Britain. There were new aeroplanes every year, which of course nowadays you're lucky to see one every sort of 5 years. But the Comet would have stood out amongst all the other aeroplanes. It had four de Havilland ghost engines buried in the wing roots, which gave it a very smooth, sleek appearance. And it could carry about 44 passengers. And it would just roar down the runway into the air, and there'd be nobody looking the other way.
But even at its moment of glory, there were intimations of the tragedy to come. Test co-pilot John Wilson.
We had a nice chap who was at that time the chief test pilot of the de Havilland Engine Company called Chris Beaumont. And he came along on quite a lot of these occasions during the demonstration at Farnborough. And it was he who discovered, standing in the middle of the gangway which led into the flight deck, that whenever one put some G on to go around the corner, the floor changed shape. And he suddenly went down like that. And it gave me a bit of an indication at that time that the structure was perhaps not all that it ought to be.
The American visitors to the show, American industry, were still very doubtful that a jet airliner could be a commercial success. But it wasn't up to them to decide in the end. It was the passengers who, when in 1952 the first commercial service with the Comet started, that many, many passengers, having experienced that, said, that's what we want.
Here is an announcement for passengers on BAC Comet Flight 113. Will you please take leave of your friends?
It was quite marvelous. The only time I had any sense of speed was on the ground. It takes 130 miles an hour to get off. Once you're in the air, it's like hanging in space.
Have you done a lot of flying in other types of aircraft?
Thousands of miles, yes. Mm-hmm. All sorts of aircraft, but never in a jet before.
People thought that the Comet was such a smooth aeroplane to fly, we used to demonstrate it with a coin balanced on the table like that, with our pilots flying it so nicely. Of course, it was a good demonstration.
No, I love the Comet. Very narrow and very small, and sort of quite sort of cosy, really. And in those days, very fast. Loved it.
Daphne Mumford, aged 21, became an air hostess, a career that was opening up for nice girls. For £6.10 a week, air hostesses could see the world and what was left of the British Empire.
In my first trip, I was sick, and the bar steward fell ill, and I had to be the bar steward on my first flight. And in those days, we had to make up fancy cocktails and things like that. We had to know how to do that. You had a board, so when they came in, you tried to memorize their name and say, good morning, Mr. Jones. Morning, Mrs. Smith. But anyway, I thought it was a lot of fun. I mean, I personally like playing tennis, so if some of the crew liked playing tennis, then I had a great time and I loved it. Others just liked boozing and just went straight into the nearest bar. Then it wasn't such fun. You didn't get these terrible drunks and these gangs of sort of football hooligans on the planes in those days, because those sort of people weren't on the aeroplanes, really.
This is the Comet airliner, Yoke Peter, the plane which made aviation history in May 1952, when it pioneered the world's first jet passenger service. Its performance thrilled the world and added a new chapter to the shining story of British aircraft and British airmen. It was with dismay that we learned that Yoke Peter, the first of the Comets, had crashed into the Mediterranean off Elba with the loss of 35 lives.
Well, of course, the first crash was bad enough in itself, at a time when we were extremely active and enthusiastic about the Comet. It was a devastating blow. But when the second one took place at the time, well, I was absolutely speechless about it. It was devastating.
After the second crash, which was also off Italy, the Comet certificate of airworthiness was withdrawn. Cyril Long and the de Havilland team had the pieces from the Elba crash dredged from the sea and brought back to England for assessment. Philip Birtle.
If you take any piece of metal, even quite soft metal, and you keep bending it, it's known that it will break. And what had happened here is the structure, because they were square windows, there was always known to be a higher load on the corner, because that's where there is a sort of pinpoint. And de Havilland's had tested these windows under water pressure to try and reproduce operational conditions, and they survived very well indeed. They survived so well that they decided that they would double the load on those windows to make really certain that the aeroplane was structurally sound. It was found during the investigations that cracks had formed between two square cutouts, and really what had happened was that the testing to double the strength had metallurgically increased the strength of the test piece, the test specimen, which the aircraft hadn't received, and therefore it was not representative of what was really going to happen. And as the crack between two square cutouts gradually progressed and they joined, then that's when the fuselage burst at 30,000 feet like a balloon.
Well, there, to the tremendous roar of power of those four Rolls-Royce Avon engines, each of them giving something around 10,000 pounds of thrust, in other words, twice the power of the original Comets, the Comet 3, the comet which will girdle the Earth with a range of 4,000 miles.
The company tried to weather the crisis by putting forward its two new versions of the Comet, the Comet 2 and the Comet 3.
Now we see the pair of them gracefully circling the aerodrome, and here comes the Comet 2.
But it was no use.
Not only BOAC, but Air France, Panair do Brazil, UAT, CPA in Canada, the Venezuelan airline, Japan Airlines, Air India, all had orders in the pipeline for development versions of the Comet, and all these were lost.
But I, of course, do remember the fact that the Comet crashes were a severe crisis, to put it mildly.
Sir Tim Rice, whose father worked for de Havilland selling planes.
But we lived right on the back of the de Havilland aerodrome in Hatfield, and every afternoon or every morning there were huge noises as jets were warmed up, like 50 Concords flying over in formation. And my father's most important job probably was in 1955, when he went out to Japan for the best part of a year to try to convince many overseas buyers that the Comet now was fixed and problems had been 100% dealt with.
Not all the difficulties were technical. Though Comets were off the scene and the V-1000 jet had been scrapped by the government, there was still commercial hope for the Bristol Britannia aeroplane. Peter Masefield was sent to America and managed to persuade Howard Hughes, then boss of TWA, to make a test flight.
He flew it very well. He took his shoes off, had no socks, and said, I can feel this aeroplane through my toes. When we landed, he said, well, I guess it does all the things you say. Will you deliver me 30 aeroplanes, one a month, from May of next year? This was August. And I will write you a check for $30 million right now. And I had to say to him, I'm very sorry. We would love to meet this order. This is the one thing we've been wanting. If we could have another 9 months, we'll do it. But BOAC orders, Canadian Pacific orders, all promised and booked and airplanes on the line. We can't order the materials to get you one a month without a 9 month interval. Afraid we can't do it. And sadly, we lost that order because we couldn't produce. But you see, this was typical of the problem of the British aircraft industry. Unless you lay down enough airplanes on the line on spec, take the risk, when the big orders come along, you can't fulfill them quick enough to meet the competition of the Americans, who do take the risks, some of them against military contracts. And so sadly, we lost what would have been about $200 million order there. And he'd have signed a check in their cabin at that moment.
In the time that was lost, while de Havilland went back to the drawing board and rebuilt customer confidence, the American Boeing Company launched the 707. The technical lead had been lost. But there was still a way to get ahead in the race to establish the first transatlantic jet passenger service.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away.
And this is an historic moment. No doubt you can hear this superb Comet 4 airliner, Delta Charlie, as it's taxiing out to takeoff. At any moment now, she'll be airborne for New York to establish a new and triumphant first for Britain, winning for Britain the race to establish the first North Atlantic jet service. And the cost, by the way, if you're thinking of making the trip, it's the normal deluxe return fare, £311, 7 shillings and sixpence.
Barbara Halbert was one of the stewardesses on that inaugural transatlantic flight, which she remembers from the cabin of the last surviving Comet 4, which is kept at the Duxford Air Museum.
I feel very nostalgic when I come back into here. That's my seat over there. We're looking through the doorway, and that's the seat where I used to sit for takeoff and landing.
She's airborne. She's She's now about getting on for 1,000 feet up, already 1,000 feet up, over the end of the airfield and heading westwards for New York. And the North Atlantic jet age has begun.
We were all worked up to a great tizzy on the day, and we had the chairman, Sir Gerard Darlanger, and all the press, and they were reporting to the general public, so it really had to be absolutely perfect.
And here on the front row, sitting beside me, is 22-year-old Brian Barnett of Dulwich in London, who's won a free trip by winning the competition for a slogan. What was the slogan, Mr. Barnett?
Comet 4, ace of space in transatlantic race.
Well, now you're on the comet, do you think your slogan is justified?
I really do. I really think that this is one of the most, it is the most thrilling experience I've ever experienced so far in my life.
Are you married?
No, I'm single.
Yes. A girlfriend?
Nothing serious. I suppose I'd better not say anything more than that at the moment, although I had to put off 2 dates to come.
Thank you very much.
We started off, as we left London, with Madeira and macaroon biscuits, followed by coffee and sweet biscuits, followed by canapés and cocktails, followed by a 7-course lunch. We no sooner cleared that away than we were off with afternoon tea. And then we started again on champagne cocktails and canapés going into New York.
Now, here's another passenger, Mr. Hal Halifax, who's not only travel manager of a famous catering firm, but he's also a well-known songwriter. In fact, Mr. Halifax, I believe you've written a song since we came aboard 2 hours ago.
That's quite true. I could just read you the lyrics,
yes,
if you like.
Please do.
We're in the air in the ace of space, without a care in the ace of space, flying high in a clear blue sky, smooth as smooth can be. It's just a rainbow to say goodbye, lucky, lucky me.
Well, that's jolly good.
We made the crossing in 6 hours and 7 minutes. I think it was 6 hours, 12 minutes, chock to chock. So this was absolutely fabulous. You know, it was wonderful making history. When we arrived in New York and landed, all the Pan American crew came out and booed us. They were very bad losers. So they booed the airplane when we landed, and we thought that was absolutely terrible.
Elizabeth Taylor arriving at London Airport with her new husband, the British actor Richard Burton. The couple, who met on the set of Cleopatra, tied the knot in Montreal and are now on holiday in England.
Flying became synonymous with glamour, so much so that even dowdy airport terminals became the natural habitat of the so-called jet set, places where they could be ritually photographed in dark glasses, in the fashionable outfits of the day. And the passenger list regularly included royalty.
My husband and I are very glad to be able to come here today to inaugurate the new Terminal 1. We are both frequent users of Heathrow Airport, and as we live at Windsor Castle, we are perhaps more conscious than many people of the immense and ever-increasing volume of domestic and international air traffic using London Airport.
Those fires are coming up now. Okay, full power coming up.
And rotary hitches, followed by the outboard.
Okay, sir, they're in okay. Outboard, select, sir.
With Boeing dominant in the commercial jet business, there was perhaps one last lead to be taken by the British. Together with French engineers, they launched the world's first supersonic jet. But the omens were not good for the next leap forward in commercial jet air travel. In 1971, the US government had cancelled its own supersonic transport project after a spend of over $1,000 million. And in June 73, the Russian so-called Konkordsky made an appearance at the Paris Air Show and, while the world was watching, crashed dramatically, killing a dozen people. After all this, orders for Concorde just didn't materialize, and country after country closed its doors on the plane on the grounds of noise, sonic boom, and environmental dangers.
We have no guarantees that the noise levels can be reduced in the near future.
and we are still faced with the continuing problems of increased levels of pollution, and there's still little known impact on the upper atmosphere.
And I'm concerned about the impact of noise on people, the effect it has on people. Because once you let the foot in for this supersonic aircraft, you can never lock the door to this terrifying noise.
Gentlemen, welcome to Toulouse. I'm very pleased to have this chance to tell you a little about the new Airbus A320, the most advanced single-aisle, 150-passenger jetliner in the world.
British plane makers are now part of the European consortium, and the Airbus company does very well against arch-rival Boeing. But both are making planes that don't look that different to the Comet. It took less than 50 years to get from the Wright brothers' first rickety plane, made in a bicycle workshop in Ohio, to jet travel 8 miles high. By comparison, in the last 50 years, development seems to have slowed almost to a halt. Tim Rice.
Sad, really. I mean, one of the things that one is always aware of these days is that there's been no progress at all, really, in passenger comfort or ease of flying in terms of speed of getting there since about 1968. And nothing has got better, other than the number of movies you can see. It still takes about the same time to get to New York or wherever. The planes are slightly less comfortable. There's been no improvement whatsoever in jet travel over 30 years, which is extraordinary. There ought to have been. You would expect that they would have come up by now with a Mach 2 jetliner that took 500 people.
The reality is that frequency of service and low cost are now the engines that drive air travel. Maybe in the distant future we will see rocket planes, hypersonic craft, something like the space shuttle that will take us to Australia in an hour. But would we like that? In the meantime, the only real development on the horizon is for slightly larger planes carrying 500, maybe 600 people. Democratic, workmanlike, but not very glamorous. More like a bus service than a magic carpet ride through the heavens.
It would be wonderful if the romance could be brought back to air travel, but I have a feeling it may have gone forever, because with everybody travelling now, it's just impossible for the airlines to handle everybody with tender, loving care. It can't be done.
Please do not hesitate to contact us if there's anything you require. Thank you.
Come Fly With Me was presented by Graham Boynton and produced by Susan Marling. It was a Just Radio production for BBC Radio 4.